And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Cleo Pascal, who specializes in geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant for the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And she was one of three recipients of the 2010 Award of Special Merit for the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
Always a pleasure. Good to hear from you. Thanks.
And Cleo, the International Energy Agency just released a report warning that the world's average temperature will increase by as much as 9.54 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. What kind of – we don't know what went on with the two presidents meeting out here in Palm Springs, President Obama and the Chinese leader, President Xi, but they said that they were going to deal with global warming and other gases, the ones that use in refrigerators, for example. But this report and what little we know about the agreement seem – there seems to be a large gap between them, shall we say.
Yeah, and it's unfortunately a bit of an indication of a failure of the Kyoto process, because both the report and what's come out of the Obama-Xi visit seems to be looking for solutions that have very little to do with kind of traditional pathways like carbon dioxide reduction. So what we see out of the Obama-Xi meeting is a potential commitment to reduce hydrofluorocarbons, which is what we started to use in exchange for the gases that we used to use that used to deplete the ozone layer. So we replaced one problem with another problem, and these HFCs, these hydrofluorocarbons, are, as it turns out, incredibly potent greenhouse gases. And so cutting that down is actually relatively easy, because when you cut down on the HFCs, you're creating a level economic playing field. Everybody is having to do the same thing. It's very easy to monitor. It's pretty straightforward. Whereas dealing with carbon dioxide emissions is much more complex, because it's implicit throughout the energy sector. So they're started sort of trying to chip away at the problem in bits and pieces, and we see the same thing coming out of the IEA report, where this sort of things that are being recommended are things like minimizing methane emissions from upstream oil and gas production, or energy efficiency, or dealing with coal power plants. It's kind of sort of saying an acknowledgement that, you know, what we've tried to do at the international level has failed, and so we're going to have to come at this problem in a whole bunch of different ways.
But the long and the short of it is they're not biting the big bullet, right? Is that they're sort of dancing around the periphery?
Well, for me, one of the biggest issues is that they're not dealing at all with adaptation issues. So as we saw with Sandy, you know, you can have 2 degrees or you can have 9 degrees, but if you're still building in floodplains or on invulnerable seaside areas, you're still going to have an impact. So yes, we need to deal, obviously, with the things that are creating or destabilizing the climate. But at the same time, we also need to start looking at, for example, how the National Flood Insurance Program works, how zoning regulations work, you know, how we continue to put critical pieces of infrastructure and lives in danger's way. You know, that situation is not getting better, not being addressed at all. And that's what's going to be hitting us hardest, fastest.
But that suggests, Cleo Pascal, that we have to accept the fact that global warming is going to change the planet, the ocean is going to rise, and that we have to essentially turn the planet into a version of Holland.
Well, the climate is changing and the oceans are rising. And of more concern, you know, you're getting increasing storm surges and unpredictable weather, and that's happening, and it's being exacerbated by even more direct forms of changing the environment, like depletion of groundwater, building in floodplains, the destruction of coastal barrier islands, those sorts of things that have nothing to do with climate change, but which we're doing anyway for a range of other generally short-term economic reasons. So there's no question that that is happening and will continue to happen. And we need to address that as well as addressing the factors that are going to affect the climate. I'm personally extremely concerned because we're at a stage now where the climate feedback mechanisms are starting to come into play. So you're seeing CO2 saturation in the oceans. The oceans are one of the largest absorbers of CO2 on the planet. And as they absorb more and more CO2, their ability to absorb CO2 decreases. So you end up with ocean acidification and a reduction in the ocean's abilities to absorb CO2. That's happening already. So once those feedback mechanisms start to come into play, once the permafrost thaws and releases more methane, you start getting all these kicks and bumps and feedbacks into the system, and it becomes increasingly destabilized. So we are at that point now. And, it's great that any initiative that the IEA or that Obama and Xi are pushing forward, great, everything is helpful. But we are in a situation now where we need to look at absolutely everything that has to do with physical infrastructure because it's all unstable.
Again, I'm speaking with Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant for the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and she was one of three recipients of the 2010 Award of Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. So given that the IEA report notes that China experienced the largest growth in CO2 emissions, and clearly a lot of that's to do with the coal-fired plants, every time apparently people can't even breathe in Beijing for most of the year. But of course, most of the CO2 that's up there now is what the U.S. and other industrial powers have put up over the last few decades. So just give us a sense then of what if we went cold turkey on CO2 and stopped it, we'd still have a problem, it sounds like. I mean, it sounds like the problem is far, far more dire than the political authorities, not to mention the business leaders, have grasped.
Yes. Yes, it is. And, I mean, for example, what happened with Sandy was predicted. The National Hurricane Center had a detailed prediction of what would happen in that sort of storm situation hitting the northeast coast of the U.S., and they have predicted that sort of thing is likely to become more common. So, it's not like the science isn't there and the science isn't being borne out. We know we have a problem, and we're seeing it happen as predicted. Now, the range, of course, may vary. It may be more or less severe, but the trend is towards increasing, extreme events, and at the same time, we're creating more vulnerable infrastructure. So there's no question, we have a problem, and some countries have, at least part of their policy circles, are positioning themselves, making that assumption. So China, for example, does have very serious domestic environmental problems, but they're incorporating environmental change into their foreign policy strategy by, for example, positioning itself very well in the Arctic. So, China has an icebreaker. It's in the process of building a second icebreaker. It's, it kind of becoming an observer at the Arctic Council. It's built the largest embassy in Iceland. It's heavily engaging in Greenland. So it is possible to incorporate the changes into policy. However, it seems to be that the main motivator now seems to be largely, economic or geostrategic, but we also at the same time need to incorporate it from a more defensive perspective so that we're not just trying to gain from it like China is doing in the Arctic, but we're also limiting loss and we don't end up with repeated strikes on, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. We were very lucky with Sandy that none of those chemical factories along the New Jersey shore breached. That's an extremely likely scenario for that kind of activity. We need to take it seriously. It's happening now.
Well, Cleo Pascal, here in the United States, it's just mind-boggling when you consider that there's still a constituency, in part funded by a couple of billionaires, the Koch brothers, to deny the very existence. So we're way behind even in terms of accepting the reality. And then on top of that, our political authorities are talking about very modest fixes at the periphery of this massive looming problem, and not really telling us anything about how serious it is, let alone how to make the radical steps necessary that would probably dwarf the race to the moon and the Manhattan Project. And then on top of that, what you're telling us is that now, beyond that, we should be thinking about what to do about the real effects of global warming, which is the oceans rising. It's already happening. And if we, if our consciousness hasn't caught up to us, the planet's going to catch up to us.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think that there's a real misunderstanding of this issue within the business community. So, you know, for example, the Koch brothers do a lot of infrastructure work, you know, pipelines and that sort of stuff. And their pipelines will be affected by environmental change. They think they think they're being clever by undermining, you know, the debate around the issue. But what they're going to find is they're going to start losing money very rapidly as this infrastructure that they're pushing through becomes undermined as, again, you know, if they're building pipelines in the north, as the permafrost thaws or as rivers flood, or, you know, there are no shortcuts. You cannot make money business as usual because the situation is not as usual. So if the business community, you know, sort of took a step back and actually looked at this, they'd realize that they need to address this for their own self-interest, for their own short-term and long-term self-interest. We did a study looking at how environmental change will affect energy infrastructure. For example, you know, the nuclear lobby in France has been pushing nuclear power as a solution to environmental change issues, which is a whole other debate. But what we found was that, you know, those nuclear facilities are actually functioning very poorly because they require a certain amount of cold water to cool their plants. Most of them are built on rivers. The rivers are running hotter and they're running lower because of climate change. And as a result, they can't cool their plants properly. So they've had emergency shutdowns, you know, in 2003, 2006, 2009, 2011, and every time they have to buy power from outside of France to supplement their deficiencies. So it's not this is not abstract. This is it's happening now, and it's costing money. And if the business sector thinks that they're being clever by ignoring it, they're not. They're affecting their own bottom line.
Well, just to add to that, believe it or not, the only nuclear power plant that's been approved in the United States is one in Georgia that's on a river that depends upon water from a river that's drying up.
Well, exactly. And that's the sort of kind of short-term assessment that's undermining the stability of our economy. I mean, the West economy is incredibly fragile now at this very moment. And there's no reason to be making these kinds of mistakes. The science is good enough now to know where the problem areas are going to be. You know, and you mentioned investment. You know, if the stimulus package funding had gone towards building defenses or stable and secure infrastructure, we would be much, much better off than if it goes towards, you know, building bridges in the same locations where they were just washed out by a flood, for example. So, you know, we have the everything is in place to build a stable, secure infrastructure that can help us economically develop and create a more secure future, but we're not connecting those dots.
Well,
as a result, everybody's going to lose, from the Koch brothers to the farmers to, you know, everybody in Vegas who's depending on a water supply that's completely unsustainable.
But what about the stimulus going towards, you know, a battery, or get rid of gas in cars and trucks and transportation? And I mean, is there any way to get off the carbon fix that we're on?
Well, interestingly, one of the IEA report makes four recommendations, and one of their recommendations is accelerating the phase-out of subsidies to fossil fuel consumption. And they make the, you know, rather interesting point that, you know, we're at a time when budgets are very tight, so why are we using our budgets to subsidize this sector? So, you know, there is a complete artificial economy built around the energy sector, right? So if you get rid of subsidies, you have, you know, renewables may become more competitive, efficiencies may make more sense, that sort of stuff. We have enormous amount of line loss, enormous amount of inefficiency. I'm here in the UK at the moment. UK government buildings produce more emissions than all of Kenya, largely because, you know, they're single-paned, rattly windows that are leaking heat, you know, at every single second when it gets cold. So, you know, we have, there are enormous areas in the systems where efficiencies can be made, but there's no economic incentive now to be efficient. We have our economic structure set up to consume, not to be efficient. So, you know, you need to look, if you really want to find a lasting solution, you need to work with economic structures that can promote healthier behavior. For example, work with the insurance sector on making sure developments don't go up in dangerous areas. Mm-hmm. You know, work with energy pricing to incentivize efficiencies and the input of renewables into the grid. You know, incentivize the creation of critical infrastructure in areas that are not vulnerable to environmental change. Price water in such a way so that you're not depleting aquifers in insane ways.
Well, Cleo, I'm so grateful that you stayed up for us, and I appreciate it very much.
Always a pleasure. Okay. Thank you for bringing up the topic again.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and she was one of three recipients of the 2010 Award of Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warming: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.